The following program is a presentation of the Flypod New Media Network, www.theflypod.com.
On the Flypod New Media Network and coming to you from Studio Number 7, I'm your host, Gary Puckett. Welcome to our program. We're pleased to have you listening in. And we do thank our syndication and hyper-syndication partners and our sponsors and underwriters nationwide. Without this active network of support, none of our programs would be possible. So when you have a few minutes, visit our media site directly, www.theflypod.com. With our nationwide team of 35 show hosts, we podcast a wide variety of programs daily to thousands of small communities across the United States, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. Virgin Islands. When it comes to the media, we are what's next. My guest today is 82-year-old Ernest Williams, and he has led, without question, one of the most extraordinary lives that I've ever encountered. And I feel privileged to speak with him about his unique collection of real-life experiences here on the show today. He has traveled a very unique path in life, and I'd like to give you a little bit of his biography before I bring him on. He graduated from Napanee High School, which is located in Nebraska, in early 1949. Then immediately for 18 months, beginning in May of 1949, he worked on an engineering and survey crew as an instrument man. He was part of a team that built a cement spillway for the Harlan County Dam, also located in Nebraska. So his exposure to civil engineering work came early in his work career, but this experience started him on a path which, with a few twists, have just been short of amazing. He then served in the U.S. Air Force from 1951 to 55 and was assigned to a special weapons program. Over the years, he acquired the specialized knowledge and talents needed to assemble and disassemble nuclear weapons, while at the same time learning the construction requirements for test site environments. After completing his official service with the Air Force, he went on to begin a 37-and-a-half-year career as a federal government service employee. As part of his work, he has been involved in 80 atmospheric nuclear tests and over 400 underground nuclear tests conducted primarily at the Nevada test site, generally known as the Nevada National Security Site. His work with nuclear tests also took him to the Marshall Islands, Christmas Island, and around the South Pacific, and as you can imagine, numerous other locations around the globe. For 15 months, he worked as a senior verification representative involving the nuclear test ban treaty between the United States and the USSR, the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, for those who don't recall, which ultimately was signed in June of 1990 by President George Bush and President Mikhail Gorbachev. He has received many honors and awards of recognition for his 62 years in the nuclear field. He is a life member of VFW Post 10047 in North Las Vegas, a member of the American Legion Post 364, and president of the All-American Veterans Club. I could go on, but rather, at this time, joining me on the phone from the great state of Nevada, I welcome a truly dedicated American, Ernest B. Williams. Ernie to his friends, so I'm going to call him Ernie. Sir, it is an honor and a pleasure to have you joining me here today.
And I thank you very much for the announcement.
Well, you're quite welcome. And having talked to you prior to the show on the phone a little bit, he's quite a humble guy, but he's had quite a list of experiences that would just make you pay attention. In my introduction, I mentioned some highlights of your career experience in the nuclear field, but I want to bring up a special point for our listeners in that you continue to this very day giving tours at the Nevada test site for the Department of Energy as an employee of an independent DOE contractor. It seems that you just never stop, but once your visitors know a little bit of your history in it all, What response do you typically receive from them during these tours, Ernie?
Relatively awesome, I have to tell you. You know, the people invariably are going to ask. I usually wear a Korean War hat, that says a veteran, and they'll say, "Gee, you got to be in your 80s." And I said, "Yes, I am." And they'll say, "Gee, how many years have you been in the program?" And I'll rattle out about 62 years. And I believe me, I got to tell you, they just get glued to you then because they realize that they have someone that was there at the time it happened.
You know, it's my understanding that to this very day, you also assist in training heavy rescue teams from first responder units from around the country. Of course, I'm not asking you to give away anything confidential and secure.
No, that's fine.
But what can you tell me about this training work you're doing with heavy rescue first responder personnel?
You know, after 9/11, there were three of us here in Vegas that were very concerned because we knew that they had walked into a lot of effort in New York, having no idea what they walked into. And we said, you know, we need to get some training. One of our gentlemen that we worked with here in Vegas was quite familiar with Washington, D.C. He got with Homeland Security, and we finally got a program on. You know, the first responders are made up of firemen, paramedics, ambulance drivers, administrative types, sheriffs, police officers, and we get them from all 50 states and some of the U.S. territories. We are trying to teach them, as first responders to a terrorist scene, how to respond to a radiological scene. And we do that very successfully. We have them here at the test site for about four long days. We run them about 10 to 12 hours a day. And we're teaching them how to operate a Geiger counter and how to respond to the injured and, you know, if it's a terrible rainstorm, you know, where are you going to have your injured so they don't get flooded out? One of the things a lot of people don't understand, if an individual has an open wound and has radiation into it, you can't take him into the emergency room at the hospital because you can't expose that radiation into that room. So you have to understand in your local community which hospitals has a morgue side of it. And I'm not trying to be facetious about it. The morgue side of the house is something that you can wash down relatively easy with soap and water.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes it convenient. So we're teaching them, you know, hey, when you get back home, you need to look at your hospitals. If you've got four hospitals in town, does any of them have a morgue side of the house? Because that's where you need to take them. You can't take a man or a woman that has an injury or a severe cut and has radiation into it. You can't take them into the emergency room.
I will admit that I don't have much depth of understanding of nuclear science and radiation, but I do know that there are multiple types of radiation. I mean, alpha, beta, gamma, and others perhaps. Can you explain in somewhat of a simple way the differences between the various types of radiation? I mean, how are they different and how differently do people approach the various levels of radiation?
I'm not a radiological person per se myself. It's one field that I didn't get into.
When we talk about alpha rays, though, I'm told that those are the least dangerous. Is that correct?
Pretty well, yes. And, you know, beta radiation is basically a negatively charged small mass ejected from the nucleus at a high-speed physics characteristic.
So when you get into gamma, you're getting pretty serious then.
Well, gamma X-rays are physically electromagnetic waves, like light or radio waves, but produce more energy. Neither the gamma radiation nor the X-rays contain mass or electrical charge. Gamma radiation exceeds X-rays in the terms of energy, shield penetration, and, you know, human energy.
Mm-hmm.
Beta, you can protect yourself from that with, you know, either lead or in some cases it can be just some sort of shielding. Could be 1 inch of lead, or you could have 3 inches of steel, or you could have 6 inches of concrete, or 1 foot of dirt.
So when you go from alpha, beta, all the way up to gamma, to protect yourself, you're looking at the need for a much more substantial, thicker...
You're going to, you know, if you're going to get involved in this, you're going to be suited up. You'll have the mask on, you'll have your gloves on, and if you're going to enter into one of these areas, with this type of radiation, you got to be properly suited up for it.
Okay.
And we do have people that did that here at the test site over the years, and we tried to protect them to the best of their efforts. You know, most people don't understand. You walk across Mother Nature's Earth from the sun and the television and the microwave oven and all those good things, you're picking up about 360 millirincons a year just off of Mother Nature's Earth and coming from the sun.
You have personally been involved in just a huge number of nuclear detonations and in the whole preparation of it and so forth. But can you describe to me what it's like witnessing a nuclear bomb test? I mean, I've seen film footage that they put out, but what does it look like? What does it feel like? And how far away from ground zero are you positioned during these things?
Well, most of the time when I went, and I, as I said to you, I've been involved in 80 atmospheric shots between Nanuitok and Bikini Atoll and Christmas Island and Nevada test site. On the average, I probably was on the upwind side anywhere between 6 and probably 18 miles. A lot of times more closer at the 6 than I was at the 18. But when you hear the countdown, and you'll hear it, you know, 10, 9, 8, 7, so forth until you hit zero, and then at the same time you've got 4.2 density goggles on. They're about 10 times darker than an arc welder's smoke glass and an arc welder's helmet. You can barely see the sun. It is an extreme bright white light that comes about probably no more than 10 to 15, maybe 18 seconds. But that white light could be seen as far as 300 miles away in the sky. And then, you know, after the light, the first thing you're going to see is the heat. You're going to feel the heat on your face if you're close enough. Please bear in mind, on one particular event, on a 22-kiloton shot, 1 kiloton equals 1,000 tons of TNT. And so at a 22-kiloton shot, I was a mile and a quarter away on the upwind side, so I won't get all the radiation that comes from it as it goes downstream. But shockwave travels a mile about every 5 to 7 seconds. Depends on the density of the air. And I got to tell you, at a mile and a quarter away on a 22-kiloton shot, it'll hit you at about 528 miles an hour.
Oh, my goodness.
And if you look at that, and then you look at the storm that was in Louisiana 5 or 6 years ago, they had 250 mile-an-hour winds. Just double that. So it was a great experience. The next thing you're going to feel is the heat. That's going to come just a matter of seconds after the event. And then the shockwave is going to hit you between 5 and 7 seconds afterwards. But this time, the fireball has now risen from detonation, and let's assume it was detonated at 500 feet off the ground. In a minute, in about 10 seconds, that fireball will be at the elevation of about 4,000 feet. On a 22-kiloton shot, that'll probably be in about a quarter of a mile wide. And I have to tell you, it is just truly awesome when you do that. And, you know, of course, I got accustomed to it. It was quite experienced to me because in uniform, I had been in the service for 3 years, assembly and disassembly of nuclear weapons, and I'd never seen a test. And when I got out of uniform and came to work for the Atomic Energy Commission, I experienced my first test in February 1955. And it just really got my... I have to be honest with you. As soon as I saw it, the sweat beads just rolled.
Wow.
I knew they were awesome. I just didn't realize how awesome they were.
Well, you're probably on a very short list of individuals who have experienced
well,
this.
You know, not trying to get off the subject. I'm very active. I do the treadmill 3 times a week. And
you take care of yourself.
I take care of myself, and I'm in excellent shape.
Let me ask you this. How many square miles in size is the Nevada National Security Site?
Well, the Nevada test site, or NNSSS. You know, come see as the crow flies, I will tell you it's about 45 miles wide and about 75 miles long. It's 1,375 square miles.
Wow. Well, a nuclear detonation is obviously a very serious operation, but I have been told that you've actually had some rather funny things happen from time to time over the years during these nuclear tests. One involving what I'll just call the inappropriate placement or positioning of some mannequins that they use at the test site. Can you tell me that story?
Well, we had a shot in May of 1955, and we also had a small city. And I mean, when I use the word small city, we had just about everything you can think of, except the water wells. We had, you know, power lines, we had television stations, we had radio stations, we had grocery stores, we had you name it. And they ranged anywhere from probably about 200 feet on up to about 10,000 feet. We had various residential homes at 2,100 feet, and then some at 38, and then we had some others at 5,000 feet.
So you built all this in the blast?
Yeah, we built this. It was a small city. We're trying to represent what all happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And so this test was put on a 500-foot steel tower. It was a 29-kiloton test. All the city is on the upwind side so that we can get back in there without having to worry about a lot of radiation content. And I can tell you that we had mannequins on the surface of the ground. We had everything you can think of. Unfortunately, this shot, the winds, we were very particular because we wanted the winds in a northeasterly direction, a very narrow wedge of the pie, because that's the least populated area off the test site and going throughout the United States. And we had to postpone it. And so one morning after we had been canceled at about 4 o'clock in the morning, one gentleman decided he would take two mannequins very uniquely and put them in bed. Well, naturally, it kind of hit the fan. We had a few words with quite a few people around the building, and I looked at the test manager, Mr. Reeves, and I said, nobody's going to, you know, they're not going to rat Fink. I said, let's just go back to work. And so, you know, I suspicioned who had done it, but I told him, I said, I'm not involved. I'm not above pulling pranks. I'm just as good at it as somebody else is. But I said, I really don't know who did this. I have my suspicions. Well, that happened in May of 1955. I didn't see Al then until 1998. And, of course, I'm also a trustee of the Atomic Testing Museum here in Las Vegas, and I saw him, and he's one of the trustees, and I saw him come in the building in 98, and I said, Al, you're the guy that put those two mannequins very uniquely in bed. And he said, yeah. And then he grinned and looked at me, and he said, good God, Ernie, did it take you 40 years to find that out?
Well, one time, I was told that one time you had, I don't know, a politician or someone with some high rank or influence who visited your test site to witness one of the tests. And, oh, let's just say that this individual was not very obedient or compliant when it came to accepting instructions prior to the detonation blast. Because of the shockwave, you know, it's obviously very powerful. Can you tell me about that incident?
That incident happened in Operation Teapot. Operation Teapot basically started in January of 1955 and went through June of 1955. And we had a congressional and senators, probably somewhere some 7 to 8 miles away from Ground Zero on the upwind side. And the gentleman that was briefing them said, you know, your shockwave is going to come through, so you need to kind of get down on your hands down on your knees and one foot in front of the other one, because when the shockwave hits, if you're just standing up kind of at a parade rest, you're going down. And so one of the gentlemen, and I don't show any disrespect to congressional people or senators, you know, one of them just decided he wasn't going to do it. And I can tell you, and the shockwave hit about 12 to 14 seconds later, and he hit the ground, and there was some construction guys behind us. And, you know, I can remember the guy, he stood up and he throwed his hand up above his head with his fist closed, and he said, I'm going to let the people know about this. And one of the construction guys looked at him, and I have to tell you, I won't repeat it all on the story, but he said, you know what? You fell on you know what, and he said, you're going to let the people know that that's what you did?
Well, throughout your career, you've been directly involved in some major construction projects, of course, related to the needed facilities for conducting both the operations and these nuclear detonation tests. What can you tell me about one of the most well-known areas? You hear about it a lot, Area 51. What can you tell me about that? I mean, what's its purpose? Why was it even erected?
I was one of the gentlemen in the very beginning. First of all, if as you are going through your efforts, you need to know that you need to go to the library, and there's a book called Area 51.
Mm-hmm.
And it's written by Annie Jacobson. And unfortunately, you'll find my name in that book quite prevalently. Yes, I was involved in 1955 helping get it built. I'm the gentleman that got the water well for them. Area 51, you know, all four branches of the service have got to have some place where they do research and development. And, you know, I can't go into a lot of details.
No, I understand. I understand.
You know, this is where, a new aircraft comes off the line from Martin Marietta or whoever that company is, and you got to put it through the tests. And they sort of have to have a secured out of the way where public won't see much of it. And that's what happens in a number of what we call or refer to as black bases throughout the United States by all four branches of the service.
Okay.
And very interesting. It still exists yet today. I have a picture on the wall here that has to do with the Blackbird. And I got some signatures onto it. You know, Blackbird was one of the things that we had early in the game. And then also later on we had the U-2. And
As
you well remember your history, Gary Powers got shot down over Russia with it.
Right.
And the only reason he got shot down is because he had a flame out at 90,000 feet and he had to get down to about 70,000 feet. And then the Russians had the capability of getting him. Had he been able to stay at 90,000 feet, they could have never got him. And then later on, I was involved in another black base called Tonopah Integrated Air Defense System. We basically did the F-117A stealth fighter there.
You also worked with astronauts Neil Armstrong, Dick Gordon, Buzz Aldrin, and others associated with America's mission to the moon and probably some other projects. But most of the training they engaged in with you was conducted at the Nevada test site, I believe. What kinds of things?
Neil Armstrong and those gentlemen came to the test site. We hadn't been to the moon yet. We surmised that there were craters, but we weren't. We had no knowledge specifically. And so we knew that we had, from underground nuclear tests, when you conduct a test underground, it vaporizes the Earth and creates a sphere down below. And as that's vaporized, and that's a pretty good-sized piece of real estate that gets vaporized, and as the gases get less and less, the soil starts to fill in the void that's been vaporized.
Okay.
And that will then come to the surface, and it's a chimney effect. And that comes to the surface, and then the earth falls in, and you get a subsidence. So we had we had a number of those at the test site. So the astronauts said, that could we come out there and get some experience? So we brought the moon lander vehicle in, and we had them with the air packs on their backs. And I spent 3 days with Neil Armstrong and them with the vehicle that we eventually wound up going to the moon with. Tried my best to get to drive it, but I never got that opportunity. But anyway, we spent about 18 hours a day in the field. We slept on canvas cots out in the field.
Wow.
We had food delivered to us, and I spent 3 days, about 18 hours a day with them, trying to give them some experience of what it is to go down into a subsidence or crater. Can use simultaneously whichever word you want. Subsidence usually is because you've had a nuclear device down below, and the chimney fell in. And a crater basically is because it came out of the ground and left a hole in the ground, you know. So, and, you know, I got to tell you, Neil Armstrong just passed away here just recently. And
yes, he did.
Tough day for me because I remember him very well, and we spent, as I said, about 18 hours a day. We had food brought to us, and we slept on canvas cots right out in the field.
To the general public, he impressed people as being a very quiet, not so outspoken man. Would you say that that's a fair assessment of him?
That's a fair assessment of him.
Yeah.
Neil Armstrong was a very dedicated individual. He didn't speak very many words, but when he did speak, you better listen.
Well, let me ask you this, Ernie. Throughout all the years of what can only be looked at as just an incredible life, but obviously there's been some exposure because of all this nuclear testing environment that you've been around. And you're 82 years old, so I guess one would just ask, how have you managed to not become sick from radiation exposure? I mean,
well, you know, I would be the first to tell you, you know, I've had prostate cancer 10 years ago. I do not affix it with the program that I worked in. It's something that the average male gets today, and
you've never
been near nuclear stuff.
Very common.
And, you know, it's just one of the common things that the male clientele gets. And so I don't accuse of the program that I worked in of getting it from them, because it just happened. You know, I'm one of the fortunate ones. I got rid of it. I've been clean for 10 years. And, you know, and from all the shots that I've been involved in, it's not on record. I'm probably pushing about 16 Rentgens, not millirentgens now. We're talking about Rentgens, and that's 1,000 times larger than a Rentgen. So I'm pushing about 16 Rentgens, a lifetime span, and I'm not having any proper any health problems.
Good for you.
Comment to you that, and I'm not a medical person, but I will tell you, you either got good genes or you got susceptible genes. If you got susceptible genes, you're probably going to get something.
There's a lot to that.
May not be cancer, but you'll get something.
Yeah. As we wrap up here, Ernie, I just wanted to ask you a question, a curious question that I had. Based on your many years of experience in this nuclear field, surely you are uniquely qualified to hold a what I would just call a more informed opinion of the nuclear arms race. So based on your knowledge, what does a guy like you think of the prospects of a nuclear Iran or the Jekyll and Hyde nature of North Korea's behavior? I mean, does it scare you more than you think it scares the average American?
Oh, I won't say it scares me any more than anybody else, but I will tell you that what bothers me probably more than anything, you know, you got to look back. The United States, Great Britain, Russia, China, and France all signed an agreement years ago that we wouldn't do nuclear testing anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We went into a moratorium, and then that finally got approved. But now you got Pakistan, and now you got Iran flexing their fingers. The only thing that bothers me probably more than anything is, you know, the big countries probably are not going to start that kind of a war because they know it's very devastating. No doubt the Iranians understand that. But my comment, I guess, is they're not a large nation, and they may not have a lot to lose. And so it bothers me a little bit, yes.
Yeah, I'm sure.
At the same time, I have to be honest with you. You know, we would like them not to obtain that data and that capability. But at the same time, I have to say to you realistically, we, as the United States of America or any other foreign country, how can we deny them, because we built it, you know, how do we deny them that? You know, it's a good question. I don't know how to answer all of that.
Well,
you.
You're right. It's a difficult dichotomy because we did it. Why should they not be able to? I appreciate what you're saying on that.
You know, sure. But the thing, I guess, that bothers me more than anything is that, you know, it's a small nation. If they get pushed into a corner, you always wonder just what will they do. You know, you'd hope that they wouldn't use it, but that's a good question, and nobody will ever know until it happens, you know.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of good things that comes out of the nuclear age. We've advanced a long ways for our nation. We've acquired, you know, a lot of good things. We did a lot of underground nuclear testing. Let me give you an example. In 1963, Great Britain, United States, and Russia, we all agreed that we wouldn't do atmospheric testing anymore. And that forced us to go underground. Well, now you have to create conditions underground to equal atmospheric conditions. And so we had some tunnels at the test site. They're about 2,000 feet in, and then you put another 2,000 feet in, so you're 4,000 feet, and you're about 800 feet from the top of the mountain, and you're about 800 feet above the water table. And in there, you'll put a long pipe. You'll pump that pipe. It's cone-shaped. It's about 1,800 feet long. It'll be 4 inches on one end and about 16 feet on the other end, and you're gonna weld it all together, and you're gonna make sure that the gamma rays, the X-rays, and the neutrons all come down on the inside of the pipe. And towards the end, you'll have test chambers.
Mm-hmm.
And in those test chambers is where you're gonna put items that are of interest to the defense of our nation, like a communication system. And I have to say to you, you know, how do we protect that so that it will not accept gamma rays, X-rays, neutrons? And eventually we come up with the products that we needed to shield those things. And the bottom line is now, you know, you're sitting out here with a missile, you got a warhead onto it, and you're going to fire at whatever country, you know, and I hope that never happens, but you want to make sure that it's properly shielded so it will not accept the gamma rays, X-rays, and the neutrons from the enemy. And we've done that.
Ernie, I want to thank you for coming on my show and speaking with me about your life of involvement in the evolution, really, of nuclear science. This has been a fascinating conversation. It makes me want to hop on a plane and travel to Nevada and take your test site tour.
Well, you know, sir, it's just a great pleasure to do it for you. Everything I've told you is not in a classified way. You can put out, and you don't have to worry about that.
Of course.
It's been a great pleasure to work with you today. I have to tell you, all due respects to the people in our nation, and I'm not saying that they're not good people. A lot of people just don't have any knowledge of the nuclear effort, you know. People are concerned about radiation. We got 104 power plants around the United States that's nuclear-powered. And, you know, the fuel rods eventually are no longer useful to the power plant, and so we have to store them. And people just, I'm not saying they're not good people. I'm not saying they're not smart people. They just don't understand radiation, you know.
Yes,
And it's sort of a shame because, and I'm not because I've worked in the program all these years, nuclear power is probably, after you get the station built, it's probably one of the cheapest energy that we can put on the power lines through our nation.
Mm-hmm.
But eventually, we got to store it someplace. Those fuel rods, as they come out of the reactor, of course, we you know, our power stations, we have all 8-foot thick concrete walls around it so we can contain it. It ain't like Chernobyl in Russia. You know, all they had was a metal building around it. We've not really had any major serious problems with them. Thank God we haven't. We're constantly, I think, getting better engineering technology. And I'm not involved in that program at all, but I keep my fingers a little bit into it just to see what's going on. But
right.
You know, but the biggest problem we have is with some of the power stations, and I'm not complaining per se, but I'm just saying, you know, coal-fired, you know, you got a lot of that smut going up the chimney yet, and we haven't been able to scrub it, you know. And it's unfortunate. We just don't have the technology to do it yet.
Well, Ernie, I want to personally thank you for your service to your country and for the advancements that you've helped along the way as we've gained through this nuclear science and the study of it all. It's hard to place a value on everything you've touched and been involved in over the last 60-plus years. I've learned quite a bit today, and I'm sure most of our listeners have as well. And listeners, we are interested in what you think of today's program. You can either leave a public comment on the listener page for this show, which is likely displayed in front of you at this very moment, or you can email us back in our main production studio, shout@theflypod.com. So, again, my guest has been Ernest Williams, Ernie to his friends, an extraordinary American who has led an almost unbelievable journey through life. Well, I'm your host, Gary Puckett, coming to you free and clear through the New Media Network program feeds of www.theflypod.com. If you have any comments, suggestions, or questions, let us hear from you. Until next time, thank you so much for joining us. And remember, when it comes to the media, we are what's next.